One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench. Hello and welcome back to Fighting on Film. This week we're bringing you the fever dream that is Castle Keep. This is, on paper, an absolute rip-roaring classic of a film. But when it comes to it, it's a little bit of a fever dream. It's a bit trippy.
Yes, it is. This has been on the FOF spreadsheet for ages, this one. So I picked it up cheap in CEX on DVD, which if you're American or international listener, it's a very cheap sort of computer exchange shop where you can get DVDs and games very heavily discounted. And it's always been sitting on the shelf, and we were umming and ahhing, and we consulted the FOF archive, if you will, and we were like, yeah, Castle Keep, 1969, that looks interesting. And boy, did we let ourselves in for an interesting time.
Treat.
Treat, yeah. So, I mean, maybe Matt, fill us in with the production, and we'll go into cast, and we'll go from there.
All right. Okay, well, as I said, on paper, it seems like it's going to be, you know, a phenomenal film in terms of production and cast and everything that went into it. So we've got Sidney Pollack directing, famous American director, producer, actor. He won an Oscar for 1985's Out of Africa for both Best Director and Best Picture. He's known for Scalp Hunters, They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, 3 Days of the Condor, The Firm, Tootsie. He produced films like The Talented Mr. Ripley and The Quiet American, and Cold Mountain as well. So, really well-respected director. The film was written by Daniel Tredash, who's known for From Here to Eternity, The Picnic, Storm Center, along with David Raphael, who's a long-time Pollack collaborator. The actual screenplay was based on Castle Keep, a 1965 novel by William Eastlake. Eastlake was actually a veteran of the Northwest Europe campaign. He was a platoon leader, and he was wounded at the Battle of the Bulge in 1945, and was awarded a Bronze Star. Cinematography was handled by Henri Daquet. Part of the French New Wave, very competent cinematographer. In terms of war movies, his other best known is probably Operation Daybreak in 1975. In terms of the budget, we're looking at about $8 million, but I couldn't find a box office. I don't know whether you did.
No, I couldn't find anything on that. There's very little on this movie out there, to be fair.
Surprising, isn't it, really? I had a look at a couple of Pollack books, and there wasn't a great deal out there to be to be found. Music was by Michael Legrand, who did the music for the 1968 original Thomas Crown Affair movie, Ice Station Zebra in the same year, and The Three Musketeers in 1973, which is a favourite. I do like that film. Mm. I like all three of those, actually. They're classic Sunday afternoon films. The film was shot in Serbia, hence the wild number of extras that we get in the film and the scale towards the end of it, yes, which really does add to the film, I think. It was largely filmed in Kamenica Park in the city of Novi Sad. And apparently the castle was made out of styrofoam. That was another little factoid that came up when I was trying to find behind the scenes stuff. And other than that, it probably has the best snow of any Battle of the Bulge film.
There's actually snow in it, which is, you know, good. You know, there's none in the Battle of the Bulge.
Although 65. I did read that filming went on so long that the snow began to melt and that became a little bit stressful for everyone.
Yes, I read that as well. Apparently they were annoyed they were wearing winter uniforms and it was like, you know, boiling hot.
Well, that's called continuity.
And I also heard that apparently they did, spoiler alert for a film that came out, you know, 50 odd years ago, that the castle genuinely burnt down, and at the end of the movie when you're seeing it burning, that's genuine footage of the castle burning. That's not controlled. Yeah,
apparently Pollock was running backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
With the K to try and like capture as much as possible.
This is great. Give me a camera on this. This is fantastic. It's genuine rolling audio there. Rolling. We want to go one shot at this.
But that's about it for production side of things. As we said earlier, there just isn't a great deal of information on it.
It's one of those interesting movies. It comes out in that sort of weird new Hollywood time where Bonnie and Clyde's come out. Hollywood's trying new things. And this is one of the movies that I think has come out in that period and was interesting and different, but I think it's been lost to time in its way. But then when you segue seamlessly into cast here, when you look at the cast, some of the people in it are very timeless. So leading your film, you've got Burt Lancaster. Mm. You know, we've had Burt on quite a lot lately, really, when you think about it. Or it feels that way, at least. Academy Award winner, listeners to the show will know his back catalogue, you know, very well. But he plays Major Falconer. He's very much the lead of the movie. And you know, listeners will know him from The Professionals, The Train, Twilight's Last Gleaming, 7 Days in May, Judgment at Nuremberg. Prolific, classic Hollywood actor there. Then we have Patrick O'Neill as Captain Beckman. In terms of his war movies, he's in Harm's Way, King Rat, and Under Siege in 1992. Then we have Jean-Pierre Amont as the Count of Malderay. He's the owner of the castle. He was in Assignment in Brittany, Charge of the Lancers, the 1955 Napoleon film, and The Enemy General. Peter Falk, Columbo's back, as he plays Sergeant Rossi. He was in Anzio, Attack and Retreat, which is an Italian war film we need to do, and Operation Snafu, but obviously, as aforementioned, you'll know him from Columbo, hugely famous for that. Then we have Astrid Heeren. She's a German model turned actress, as Therese Del Malderay. She's the countess. She's a very small, has a very small credit list, but she was in The Thomas Crown Affair, Silent Night, Bloody Night, and seems to have, only those four big credits, really. Then we have Al Freeman Jr. as Private Benjamin. Now he's kind of he's the writer of the group. So the way the movie works is that they say to Private Benjamin that he should write a book about this. And this film is essentially his book. So he was in Torpedo Run, Sniper's Ridge, Roots, The Next Generations, and the film Malcolm X. And in Roots the Next Generation, he played Malcolm X, which is quite an interesting little sort of bit of trivia there.
Yeah.
Then we have Scott Wilson as Corporal Clearboy. He was in Young Guns 2, Geronimo, An American Legend, the 1995 Judge Dredd, G.I. Jane, Pearl Harbor, The Last Samurai, and he also appeared as Herschel Green in The Walking Dead. Hopefully, Walking Dead fans
kind
out
of
there.
A career resurgence, bit of a lift towards the end. I think he died a couple of years ago now, didn't he?
Ah, right. Yeah, I think so. Mm. Then we have Tony Bill as Lieutenant Amberjack. He's an actor and director. He was in None But the Brave, Man from U.N.C.L.E., Ice Station Zebra, and in terms of his directing credits relevant to the show, he directed Flyboys, if you remember, Matt.
Oh, of course he did.
Back in the time, yeah. But
from a few months back. Great film.
Yeah.
Absolute classic.
Much like this film. Very interesting. It's what you say.
I can't see any through line on it, but yeah. Carry on.
When you want to be non-committal, Matt, you just go, it's very interesting. Yeah, mm. Just say that. It's get out of jail free saying. It's not bad, it's not good, it's just interesting. Then we have James Patterson as Elk. His credits include Silent Night, Bloody Night, Hawaii Five-O, the Mission Impossible TV series, and The Defenders. Then we have Bruce Dern, something of a cult hero, as Lieutenant Billy Bix. He's an Academy Award nominee. He was also in Pollack's They Shoot Horses, Don't They? He was in Silent Running, The Burbs, Nebraska, The Hateful Eight, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Very much of that era and that 60s sort of new wave era. But a proper, you know, proper cult character actor there. Then we have Katrina Barato as the Red Queen. She's the mistress of the brothel that the American GIs find themselves in. She's an Italian actress.
That's a trip, that scene.
I know, it really is. She was in a film called Sallow, 120 Days of Sodom, Federico Fellini's 8.5, and Campo di Fiori. And then rounding out the cast, we have Olga Beressa as Baker's wife. That's the character's name. And it will become clear later why there's a Baker's wife.
They really gave
her
a backstory, didn't they?
They really did. She's in Superfly TNT. She makes an appearance in The Spy Who Loved Me in a film called Safari Rally. So that's your cast there. And it's good. But I think that cast stands a test of time way more than the actual movie does.
On paper, definitely. I mean, it's frustrating, isn't it? You go into it and you're thinking, okay, it's going to be a late 60s exploration of man's duality and conflict. And it's going to be an anti-war film. But then even at the time, like New York Times critic Vincent Canby said, the film accomplishes the dubious feat of being both anti and pro-war at the same time.
Yes.
And that kind of sums it up a little bit for me in that this film is a little bit muddied. It's not a straightforward film. And it leans heavily into that surrealism that came into film in the late 60s. Mm.
It's tonally all over the place. So I think maybe we should do the one word review.
Doesn't know whether it wants to be a comedy or a dark anti-war film or just an all-out, like, show 'em up.
Yes, or Kelly's Heroes Light in some places as well. Like, I got that vibe from it.
Yeah, Kelly's Heroes does a big old lump of crack.
Kelly's Heroes on MDMA.
On LSD.
It's not a bumper kit off a key. It's gone crazy. There. It's in a K-hole. It needs to be taken home and made a cup of tea and bought a kebab at 3 a.m. That's the best way to describe Castle Keep. It's Kelly's on Ket, everyone. Things I thought I'd say on this show. So getting into the one word reviews this week, we have Historical Firearms Matthew Moss goes with bread, but he's written it in a long form, which is bread. Andy Moody just says, looking forward to this one, haven't seen it in years. Kevin Getz goes with tripping. Paul Hicks goes with unknown. Jim Dudaku gives more of a few words, but we'll let them in. He says, one of those insane 60s World War II films that's more about the 60s than World War II. Not very good. All the action is very of its time and nowadays is a waste of time. Brian Williams goes with eccentric. Yeah. And Simon Whippet says, just one more thing. Obviously got to get Columbo in there. I don't think I've seen it. We'll check it out post-review. Pete the Paint says eye patch, and Ian Davidson goes with unheard of. So I think the general consensus was that this movie is kind of just, I wouldn't say it's a lost film, because it's definitely not.
Yeah, I was going to be mildly humorous and have done the production for The Keep rather than Castle Keep, just for a laugh.
That won't be the first time that we've come on the show. I had to quickly scramble behind the scenes there for everyone. There was a week where Matt and me, because if you listen to the show for a long time, you'll realise that me and Matt alternate production and cast. And there was one week, I forget what movie it even was, but there was a...
Oh, I can't remember now.
There was a moment where I went to do cast and Matt looked at his notes and he was like, hang on, I've got cast here as well. So we had to pull production notes out of our ass, essentially, for that one, which was very funny. No,
we paused the recording, went away and did our due diligence, Rob. Yeah, we didn't just pull it out of our ass.
No, but we essentially had to, really. But yeah, this one's an interesting one. I think, as you say, it's just, it comes out in an odd time. This is Kelly's Heroes, but has gone too far, if that makes sense. Like,
Kelly's is accessible, and it remains timeless because it doesn't go too far into the surrealist exploration of war that films like this one do. So if you look at this film and if you come into it like through and there's a load of women in like burlesque outfits throwing brandy Molotov cocktails at a T-34/85. You go, what the hell is this
going on? Yeah.
If you came into it 45 minutes earlier and it's a guy that's looking at the lieutenant that's looking at the painting in the parlor of the castle and it starts moving.
It comes alive.
You'd be like, what the fuck is this?
It's like tells the unexpected, what's going on?
Yeah, or the sequence where Burt Lancaster shoots seven members of a German patrol without taking any, possibility of return fire.
Oh, it's that's like, nails. Absolute nails.
Concealment is not cover, Bert. That like bandstand is not bulletproof, but apparently it is.
It's Bert. It's come on.
It is. I mean he sells being able to shoot all those guys.
Oh, he does. Yeah. He's taking the film bloody seriously, I must admit. If that's the character, then fair enough. But if that's how he chose to act it.
Someone does. Someone needs to.
Yeah.
We got Falk in the bakery, just like absolutely gone.
Gone.
We'll talk about that in favourite scenes. I know.
Yeah,
but
we will.
He's gone.
We will.
He's just like bread. Bread. I'm like, a baker here. Bread.
I'm a baker now.
And everyone's coming in going, can I get some bread? And he's like, yeah, here you go. Like, I don't want to do this, but someone needs to like explain to Peter Falk that a bakery is a for-profit business where you just can't give bread to everybody. You actually need to like...
It's being the best socialist baker he can be. He's giving it away for free.
Absolutely true.
To sort of back up what we've been saying there, I found a retro review from RogerEbert.com. It's not that retro, it's 2021, by Scout Tafoya as part of a series of unloved movies. And he says this, there's no way around how Sidney Pollack's Castle Keep has aged awkwardly. Half of its jokes don't land and never did. And it was written and directed by people who sacrificed artistry for cleverness. But there's undeniably a kind of odd magic at work here. How many people were interested in showing warfare as simply the province of absurdity and in showing the battlefield as not a transformative place, but simply a graveyard waiting for bodies? Released in 1969, Castle Keep is too cute, perhaps, to be the profound thing it intends to be, but there is a fairly accurate study of cabin fever, of living in a society that has lost its walls and ceiling, that we're all on our own now, and it's up to us to decide what happens next, at last. And I think we can all now relate on some level to that.
Interesting. I think it hits a number of interesting points there, like good points, in that a lot of the stuff doesn't land and probably didn't with audiences at the time either. Because some of it is just like, this is too either far out or just patently like not relevant to what we're doing here. And I think the mention of like cabin fever, is really interesting. And there's elements of this film that if you reshot it with the soundtrack of The Shining, then
you
could have a really interesting mashup, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But there's a definite feel and atmosphere of that Cabin Fever element to it. But then tonally, the film shifts around so much that doesn't remain for long.
We're
isolated in this castle. Oh, wait, we can go to a brothel in the town, which is like 5 minutes away.
Yeah, and the town's untouched.
A private soldier is apparently having a weird relationship with a VW Beetle. And then, out of nowhere, a flare goes up like 3 miles away. And Bert instantly knows that the entire German army is coming their way.
And he holds a lecture telling them the entirety of how the bulge is going to go down, and he wouldn't know a damn thing. And I absolutely love that. I thought that was amazing.
I love the art lecture that the captain gives.
Yeah.
Because, oh my God. So the film begins with a Jeep slowly ambling down a potholed road towards the castle. And we get some backstory. We get the captain's backstory of he is there to look after artwork, or he's on like a bit of a Monuments Men-esque kind of background to him. There's the major, and then there's the author, the writer.
This was better than Monuments Men. I'll say that now.
Monuments Men is long overdue for a review on this show, because
Monuments Men was a wasted opportunity for a mini series cut down into a movie that doesn't bloody work. That's what I think Monuments Men is.
Monuments Men is, do you remember that episode of The Simpsons where he invents a gun that applies makeup? That's Monuments Men.
Wow. I mean, it just throws everything at you and expects it to stick. Is that what you mean? Because then Castle Keep is very much like Homer's makeup gun.
That's true, actually. That is true. Might be our most niche Simpsons reference.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But it works so well, Matt. That's perfect. You've done Final Thoughts already, like half an hour early, I think you've done it.
It's the makeup gun from The Simpsons.
It's the makeup gun from The Simpsons. Hold still, Marge.
This episode is going to be our Castle Keep. I can feel it.
It is. Yes.
People are going to listen to this and go, oh no, this film's really affecting. I'm sat here with a typewriter just writing Red Rum over and over again.
No TV and no beer. Make Burt Lancaster something. Maybe we should take a breather and get to the Alley Tally.
Hope everyone gets the Simpsons references that we push into this far too often.
Of course they do. It was a cultural phenomenon.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, It's time for Ali Tally on Fighting on Film.
So, I mean, if you haven't worked out already, the film is a bit madcap, to say the least. But in terms of the Ali Tally this week, it's not actually that bad. Mm. Like, for watch the trailer if you haven't, or indeed watch the whole movie. It's out there online. Like, the war movie part of it is absolutely fine. There's not much going wrong for a late 60s World War II American war movie. There's nothing wrong. You know, you've got BARs in there, M1 Garands. There's a really cool 50 cal on an aerial mount. It's really cool. You get Peter Falcon on MG42, which is lovely to see. M1 Garands as well. Germans in Feldgrau. So I think maybe without realizing it, they're leaning into the tropes a little bit, which kind of might help the film in a way.
I think that's fair. T-34-85 is painted grey.
Love it.
Classic.
There's some great lines about
3.5-inch rocket launcher.
That's cool.
Used, which is it's great because what a fever dream of a scene that is, where the tank's coming into the church.
Oh, I love it.
And we'll just pretend that his bow gun and his coax are jammed, and the tank's coming into the church.
Yeah,
and they're stumbling to reload. And he aims the rocket launcher, which is supposed to be a 2.75-inch, but we'll let them off. It's actually 3.5, but that's very common. It's an M20 Super Bazooka. You look straight down the tube, and there's nothing in it. And then he pulls the trigger, and it pulls the tank up. It's classic trope.
I knew you'd see that.
Yeah.
But the thing I love about that scene is that he's reciting the Lord's Prayer, trying to like buy them some time, and then he's like, shoot the goddamn son of a bitch, and then he fires it like right at the last moment. It's really great.
It's a good scene.
That tank scene is quite funny, actually, because once they get in it, they're like, do you think, or Peter Falk goes, well, do you think we can be arrested for wearing a German tank, which is a great line.
It's an incredible line, and Falk's delivery of that line is perfect. Yes. But what annoys me is, where does the tank go when they get back to the castle?
Fuck knows. I reckon they crashed it. Like, there must be a cut scene, and they
Falk's jammed up the innards with bread.
The bread. They should have had it. I don't know why they didn't have a scene where Falk like disables a tank by sticking some bread in the exhaust pipe or something. Like, why did they not do that? Or like a baguette down the barrel of the gun. That would have been amazing.
That's a really huge missed open goal for this kind of film.
It really is. Yeah.
Some slapstick surreal bread action.
Yeah, exactly. But the tanks are absolutely fine. That's a trope in itself. I like the amount of uniforms that were on display because I just wasn't expecting to see them.
Oh, that scene where the guys are retreating through the town and there's hundreds of guys. I mean, insane uniforms in there. It's like there's absolutely wild stuff.
Like duck hunters, and there's guys in like parachute jump uniforms. There's some random British troops in there, which means fully decked out. Which means this movie might be the second movie to acknowledge the fact that there was a British contribution to the Battle of the Bulge, which I wish we had known about before we did our talk, because it would have been an insane...
Oh, my God. Can you imagine if we'd included it?
It would have been brilliant.
Two frames of a dude wearing a Brodie with an SMLE.
Exactly.
And that gets into the talk.
Yeah, it bloody would have done. And then I love the fact that after that sequence, Burt Lancaster somehow is just now wearing a jump uniform for the rest of the movie. It just makes no sense.
What's that about? Was Burt like, I'm too warm in this. I want to change.
Yeah. Might have been that, actually. That's a fair shout, you know.
But, you know, that's the least weird thing of the film, to be fair.
It is, actually. Once you get to a certain point with this movie, nothing phases you, I think.
Yes, that's very true. The bit with Falk with the grenade is very cold.
Oh, yeah. That is good. Mm.
That's a good grenade.
I like it. Yeah, yeah. The more conventional war movie trope bits where they're digging in and things like that, you don't normally see that in movies of this era anyway. So that was nice.
Yeah, that's normally like sort of just like dusted over, isn't it? And we see them like setting up their defenses and stuff, which is cool. And it turns into our last stand film. And yes. You know, that's the film's like sort of final tonal shift.
Into Lancaster telling them to reposition the mortar, which is really cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lancaster has... Do you notice his little dad run that he does? Once you notice the way Lancaster
all
runs...
All of the skipping over the tiny hedgerows, I was like, oh, damn, that's cool. And it lingers on him for an awfully long time doing that. He runs like 300 yards in that sequence.
He can't shift at that. This point in his career, the knees are gone, and he's done too many westerns.
Yeah, but he's making it look like he's moving.
Mm. He does,
you know, at speed.
I only wish the film had gone as quick in that sequence, because Christ,
that is true. Yeah,
the pacing, right? But then I also like the just rounding out my Ali picks for this week is I love World War II winter looks. So,
yeah,
I love great coats, Mackinaw coats, scarves, mittens, all stuff like that. I love seeing it. And there's
we get a fair bit of that.
We do. Peter Falk wears a lovely Mackinaw in it. I love him.
He wears a lovely baker's outfit.
And a baker's outfit, which I never thought I would ever say.
That man is like the most flour-covered baker. Like they turned to Peter and said, Peter, you're a baker. And he just ploughed his face into some flour and was like, I'm a baker, and came back up and just did the scene.
That was the cocaine to get him through the scene. That's not flour.
It literally is like this scene in Scarface where he like covered in it.
Just jams his head into a pile of flour, yeah. But thank God. I think we'll transition to favourite scenes now, because we're getting there with Peter Falk with the bakery.
Hello there. Sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
So, favourite scenes. So, talking about Peter Falk there, Falk is the perfect actor for the role. There's no, for me at least, there's no one else. There probably is someone else in that era, maybe Don Rickles, maybe someone like that, comedic actor. But Falk has this conviction and the comedy to his acting.
Yes, the timing.
And the timing, yeah, to make this absurdity work. So Rossi reverts back to his pre-war occupation as a baker in an attempt to like sort of see out the war. It's clear he's going through some post-traumatic stress. I think that's what he's trying to get at. And he reverts. So all the lads learn that there's this town and there's a brothel. And Falk's like, oh, there's a bakery. So he goes, instead of there being, oh, you're not going to come to the brothel, Rossi? He's like, no, where there's a bakery, there's a baker's wife. And which is an amazing line. And he sort of just adopts this family of his own because the baker's gone AWOL, which is nuts.
That's a trope in of itself.
It's crazy, yeah. So, and the wife just invites him to bed because he's a baker and she's a baker's wife. Yeah. You know, Falk becomes the fabulous baker boy for a bit. And then near the end of the movie, this is my favourite scene, this part now I'll segue into. Just you have to have the context there or this doesn't make sense. Most of the movie, actually. So near the end of the film, Falconer is trying to rally a force to defend the castle and stop the German advance.
Yes.
So the lads, Falconer's chaps, go and say, go get Rossi back. And he's baking. So you get a sequence of them trying to convince him to come back into the fold for one last battle. And he actually has some really interesting lines, and he's probably one of the few characters in the movie that actually gets fleshed out and you learn a bit more about him. And he says, you know, do you want to end the war? And he goes, well, I've been trying to end the war forever, basically. And he says, I landed in North Africa. I was going to end the war that day, then in Normandy, then the next day, then the next week. When I reached the Siegfried line, I figured out, maybe it's going to take me a year. But then when I realized it was going to go into centuries, I came here, started a small family and a reasonable business. It's just amazing. And he's in the baker's whites. He's got flour all over his face.
It's the reasonable business bit that gets me. It's so bizarre. I love it.
Exactly.
It's just like, and the baker has gone off and been killed in the war, ostensibly. Yes. And he just takes that family under his wing.
He does. He really does. And then he has another great line, like 2 seconds after that, where they're saying about, you know, how are you going to stop a German tank? You know, they don't just give them up type thing. And they're saying, oh, with a bazooka. And he's sort of saying, he's talking about something else. And he leans into the guy who's just said about a bazooka. And like reverting back to being a soldier, he goes, you know, how are you going to take a tank away from the Germans? It's theirs. And he goes, and he just leans in and goes, aim for the track. They bounce off the armor. And then he goes back on to talk about baking. It's just, it's like a Michelin Web sketch. It's like, it's just so well timed. That sequence there gets the comedy that the movie was going for. And
that's a very good point, actually.
That's, for me, this is the sequence where it works, because you've got your strongest comedic character.
If they just made the comedic element one or two characters, mainly Falk, I think the film would have been a lot stronger, because a lot of it is just weird.
There are too many jokes that don't land. Yeah. And it detracts. I think it detracts from it.
I would agree. The Falk Baker scenes are great. I do love those. They're a personal favorite as well. I like the whole inaction in the town. I like that. I love
that's
the way
really
that,
good. That's actually
Lancaster
really good.
Is shot on that horse. Cinematography. Oh, fuck me.
The camera work.
In terms of cinematography.
Yeah.
The camera work. Yeah. It's very good. Not how he's actually shot on the horse, but it looks great. And the bit where he finally rallies a group of men by using Bruce Dern and his band of religious, conscientious, objective zealots.
Bruce Dern's carols, like singers, it's just,
which is
absolutely
insane.
Nuts. Yeah.
Yeah. He's there, like, that's another great sequence with Falk, actually. So
he is actually,
Bruce Dern's outside the brothel singing Christmas carols and like shouting about how, you know, sins are being committed inside.
Yes.
Falk comes outside with his rifle and he's like, can you not?
Can you
not?
Up?
I'm trying to ingratiate myself with the baker's wife and this reasonable business.
Yeah, in my
and,
small
and
family.
And he's just like, you wake up the whole town and he fires the rifle in the air and Bruce Dern's like shocked.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, that's really weird. Are we going to see Bruce Dern and the boys again? And we do.
Because
he runs into Bert Lancaster, Major Faulkner, and he's trying to rally these retreating men. He says, like, where's your officer? Where are you going? To a couple of them. And he says, my officer's up there. I'm going over there. And there's a lot of, like, dazed dudes in the crowd.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he realizes he needs, like, a song.
Like a pipe almost.
Yeah, exactly. About to say that myself. And he gets Bruce Dern and the boys to sing at the muzzle of a 1911. He's like, just sing. I need you to sing. He's like, I don't want to lead these men off back into war. And he's apparently, Bruce Dern's convictions aren't strong enough to prevent him from doing this, because he does it. And he manages to gather looks like about 200 guys. And you think, oh, okay, that's going to make defending the castle much easier.
Yeah.
Oh no. They go around the side of a building. You got Bert on his white horse, followed by the Pied Piper, Bruce Dern and his boys, and then this, you know, 100 or so guys. And then an artillery barrage lands, destroys the building, kills all of them.
Everyone. Yep.
All of them. Except for Bert of course. Yeah. And he comes riding back through the dust and the debris. And it's a brilliant shot. I love that.
The only thing that ruins it is you get a Terrence Malick thin red line tambourine falling down in the middle of the debris, like wishy-washy shot, which I fucking hated. I was like, oh, it's Terrence. He's struck early.
But the whole holding the town section of the film is It's quite fun. It's yeah. well done. It's well shot. It leads nicely into the final act of the film. There's some surreal bits where they're using like just a cardboard box as cover.
Yeah, I like that. That really
guy,
leans
a
into
guy
tropes.
Runs across the street at one point to take cover in the smallest shell imaginable.
Is that the guy with the 30 cal? And he goes, "I'm going to take cover over yeah. there. I'm going to move." And the two guys sort of react like he's crazy. I really love that. See that little sequence there. There's so many. I think that's Pollack trying to show the absurdity of some of these sequences at the time. Because it feels that way. Mm-hmm. Like there's a German that runs into the middle of the street and like takes a machine gun position up, and the guys just light him up because he's not like in any cover. That sequence technically is very good. I think it's a much better than the later scene.
Fought with the grenade as well in that bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That for me is the stronger sequence. Of action that we get. I think the bit at the end is too
yeah.
over the top.
The climax of the film almost feels a little bit rushed in the Germans kind of just overwhelm the defenses very quickly, which not unbelievable.
No, there's not many of them.
Not unbelievable.
Yeah,
exactly. But I think Pollack captures that, you know, the weight of the advance quite well because it's quite tightly shot. From about 90 degrees off to the German advance and the defense. So it gets like this kind of almost just very straightforward linear view of what's going on for some of the actual like shots. There's the bit where they're all wounded and they're in like a dried up pond.
Yes.
Falk and the lieutenant and someone else. And, you know, they're about to make a break for the moat to swim across the moat. So they drop the drawbridge down so they can get into it. And the camera lifts up and sees just how close the Germans are to them.
Mm.
And the voices kind of fade away. And you never see them again. And I thought that was really well conceived
and
shot.
Yeah, and it implies they died, didn't it? Like that they imagined it. They didn't actually do it. And that, I think that sequence doesn't hit as much as it could because it takes so bloody long for you to get there. And I was watching it, and I'm not saying that I know what was going to happen or anything like that, but I guessed that they were dead because it was taking so long. I was like, oh, hang on, they're not going to make it, are they?
Yeah.
And I was, if you're ahead of the movie in your brain, you're like, come on, you're just waiting for it to happen. And then any sort of goodwill that scene creates. And we're getting into final thoughts again. We always do it. But then it's killed off like 5 minutes later when you've got like fire engines coming through and Burt Lancaster.
Oh my God, I forgot about the fire engines.
And
that's insane.
And Burt Lancaster shooting like 10 million rounds out of this 50 cal. And like it goes a bit like Western-y sort of last defend the fort type vibes. And it's just.
Yeah,
any sort of good graces the film builds up, it's really happy to kill them off quickly, and that might be Pollack's vision, but
and
it doesn't make.
I think it is because, and I think that's it. I think that is Pollack's vision of to have this huge, ridiculous climax, the grandstanding of Lancaster on the 50, the castle burning down, and I think what he's trying to get across is though it's a almost a pastiche of that. 60s, 50s tendency to have a huge final climax battle where everything either gets destroyed or killed. And I think that's very true. But before we move into final thoughts, I thought I'd round up some of my favorite scenes.
Sure.
We've got to talk about the scene with the VW.
Oh, it's like a Mighty Boosh sketch.
Where Lancaster... Well, let's talk about the first part where it's like, introduced. Lancaster comes over and talks to Wilson, and it's implied that he's having a sexual relationship with the VW Beetle.
It's nuts.
Which is absolutely insane, and probably the first time I most audiences of the day would have encountered the concept of a human being physically attractive to a piece of machinery, which is a thing. I've forgotten the term for it, but it is a thing. I remember watching a Louis Theroux documentary about it. That was one of the weird weekend ones, I think.
I think it might have been, you know,
And Lancaster sort of explains, Wilson sort of explains to Lancaster why he loves the car. It's like, it doesn't need any water.
It's like it's like a mechanical horse.
It drinks a thimble full of oil. I love it. And Lancaster's so far gone at this point and just is just like, okay,
all right,
carry on, and walks away.
Later on,
a couple of the guys push the beetle into the moat, thinking it's going to sink, and like a bit of spite. Ha, Wilson's girlfriend's in the moat, kind of thing.
Yes,
and
nuts.
It floats to the surface. It's surreal. And he pulls out his pistol and starts trying to shoot it in order to let the air out of it. That just stopped the film dead for me. I was like, why is this in here? Like, that is not going to... doesn't hit. It doesn't make sense. And it doesn't do anything for the plot or characterization. It's insane.
Yeah. And then he drives
moving on
it
to
out
another
of the stream,
another aspect of the film.
Fucking crazy.
Yeah, and then how does he get into the moat, Rob? He goes he goes, oh my god, the car.
This movie
he goes to run like
logic.
Around through the he goes to run and like go through the drawbridge, etc. And someone goes, no, not that way. Go that way. It's quicker. And he sort of like doubles back on himself, goes through a door that opens out. Just opens out into nothing. He runs through it and falls into the moat below.
Yeah.
And then swims into the car and drives it out.
And it's crazy. It was as I said, it's like a Mighty Boosh sketch. It was like something out of Monkey Dust. Like if listeners know what Monkey Dust is.
This is going on, Bert Lancaster is knocking off the Count's wife.
Yeah.
And there's a whole tension of the with the Count and the Countess and Lancaster in this weird love triangle.
Yeah.
Where the Count wants a child. He's impotent and he wants a child. And he's like, I'm just going to put up with it and hope I get a child out of this. And I'm like, okay. And there's a bit where he hands the Count a pistol when they're defending the bandstand from that German patrol.
That's it.
And he kind of considers shooting Lancaster in the back, but doesn't. And then there's a number of conversations where he explains the concept of him wanting a child, etc.
And there's too much going on.
So
it's too much going on at the times. I think maybe that does bring us into final thoughts. Like, some of the scenes are very interesting and done in an interesting way. So as we said, like the battle sequences are good enough. I think it's a worthwhile watch, but boy, you're in for a hell of a ride. Like, and then I think at the end of the day, when all is said and done and you sort of reflect on the movie, tonally, it is so wishy-washy. It really doesn't know what it wants to be. And it's just a little bit flawed. Like, the concept is interesting, but it's not, it doesn't lean in too far one way. It doesn't lean in too far off the other. And I think kind of like an absurdist comedy, tongue-in-cheek kind of war film, Kelly's Heroes a year later just gets it much better. Like, Kelly's Heroes just gets that formula. And I think the cast is better as well in Kelly's Heroes as well, even though I love Lancaster and I love Falk. If this movie had more recognizable stars in it, I think it might have survived the years a little bit kinder, because it's just there's too much of one, not too much of the other. And I think
it misses its mark. It misses
its
mark quite.
It does
a considerable margin, doesn't it?
It's
just a little bit too avant-garde. It's trying to be too surrealist. It doesn't really achieve what it aims to. And I go back to that quote from, I think it was New York Times, where it says it has the distinction of being both anti and pro-war at the same time.
Yes.
And I don't think the film's supposed to be pro-war. I just think that it tonally, as we've said, it misses the mark in that it doesn't nail down the anti-warness of it, or at times it isn't clear enough with what it's trying to say. the climax is pretty spectacular. You know, there's some great dialogue that we've talked about. There's a lot of ponderous sort of like pseudo high concept stuff going on with paintings coming to life and people having monologues, the art historian giving a talk to people that aren't interested in it.
It reminded me of uni. I was like, fuck, hell no, not again.
It was like the least engaged. Like a Friday afternoon seminar. That was what that
Christ.
Was. Everyone wants to go to the pub. And as we've said, it tries to be humorous.
Yeah, it does.
It tries to be funny. It tries to be humorous. But tonally, it just moves too far across the spectrum too rapidly all of the time.
And it's
doing anti-war. It's doing surreal. It's then doing sort of a Last Stand film. But then it's also trying to pastiche the absurdity of the climaxes of contemporary war movies. And it's also trying to do that thing where the film looks at the absurdity of war and conflict by putting it into a surrealist kind of optic where, oh, we're in a brothel and there's a woman playing an organ. And
How mad is this, guys?
A painting having a chat with me.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the prostitutes are now throwing Molotov cocktails at the tank without any problem at all.
At times, I feel like you can hear like a director or a producer going, oh, look, guys, look how crazy this is. This shouldn't be in a war film, should it? Oh, look. You know, that's how I kind of feel at certain times. That's just what the movie's going for. It's kind of just trying to be like, this shouldn't be in a war film, guys. How crazy is this? And you're thinking, well, yeah, it would work if you cut out some of the slower sections and you really... But like
you find that comedic tone that you're trying to go for.
Exactly. Yeah. If it was quicker, if the jokes were funnier, if you had more of Falk, I think it might be a much better movie. Because it just
there's other films do explorations of the absurdity and the tragicness of war better.
Oh, we must
look at the Bridget Ryan Megan. That does an examination of. You know, the absurdity of throwing men against a you know something that isn't going to be there for long. You know,
And
I don't think this film nails the necessary tragic realism. So there has to be some sort of element that really binds everything together, and I don't think this film quite achieves it. But nevertheless, it was interesting.
Yeah, it was. I would recommend it in terms of, you know, if you're a fan of.
The genre,
if you're a fan of cinema history, seeing how new Hollywood was sort of the new wave of Hollywood directors and the way of
Pollock's approach to a war movie.
Exactly. Like it's one to check out just to see where the genre can go. And it's not just another black and white, you know, the good guys shoot left, the bad guys shoot right type thing. It's not just that. But I can see why it has.
If you can forgive some of the surrealist elements, it is a film that does make you think a little bit, I suppose.
And if you're a Columbo fan,
is its aim, I suppose. I mean,
check out Falk Bacon.
It's got Falk. Yeah.
Bacon and bazookas.
Bread.
There you go. There's the three B's of Castle Keep there. So, yet again, thanks again for listening to Fighting All Film this week. That was Castle Keep 1969. Bit of a mad one. I think it fried our brains a little bit. Please go and do check it out.
This is definitely our Castle Keep episode.
Yes, it is. This is our Castle Keep episode. Next week, we have Paul Epstein on the show for an interview. He is a documentary film maker and producer out in America. And we're going to be talking to him about all things making documentaries. And I'm sure a lot more as well. So do join us for that next week. Keep abreast of everything that's going on in the show on our social media. You can check us out on Twitter at Fighting On Film. Oh, no, X now. Sorry. X at Fighting On Film. I'm never going to get used to that.
We're also on Threads. We're on Instagram. You can find us at fightingonfilm.com. That's the main one to go to.
Yeah, please go there.
We've got some new shirts out available as well.
We do.
Celebrating our recent 150th. But I think that's about it. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.